principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Welcome to Soundings. The National Humanities Center recently convened a discussion of journalism and literature. The participants are Dr. Hugh Holman, a scholar of American writing who specializes in the literature of the South, and a professor at the University of North Carolina. Vermont Royster, former editor of the Wall Street Journal, and Edwin Yoder, editorial page editor of the Washington Star. The discussion focuses initially on the connections between journalism and literature. Speaking in order are Dr. Hugh Holman, Vermont Royster, and Edwin Yoder.
I would say, of course, they share the same roots. They're both the attempts to give in writing the record of something. I think we begin at this, with this. Either the record of events, the kind of oldest forms of chronicle, or else the record of an imagined event, which we get in the case of the earliest forms of fiction. And I suspect that poetry is related, at least in certain respects, to the journalistic impulse in its beginnings, because poetry probably began as a mnemonic device, a way of remembering. And the early poetry was probably designed to enable people to report and continue to report, repeat reports with some fullness and accuracy. I think journalism and literature fundamentally are both attempts to deal with human experience in the world through words in some permanent form. And to that extent, of course, it seems to me there's no fundamental difference in them. And in the beginning, I think there was even less than we think we detect today.
Well, the first difficulty that I have is defining the word literature. To me, a thing becomes, lifts itself out of the ordinary category, becomes literature when A, it can be read by a wide audience, when B, it is worth rereading, it is reading a second time, and thirdly, when it appeals to another generation from the generation time in which it is written. In other words, it has a certain durability. Now, in that sense, I think an awful lot of journalism can very well be classified as literature. Frankly, I think journalism antedates what we now think of as literature. Xenophon's Anabasis, the story of the war, is certainly literature. It's certainly journalism. It's written on the spot. It was an eyewitness account because he was actually participating in the war. Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, certainly journalism. It's certainly literature in the sense that it has endured over centuries and can be read with as much profit today as it could be read at the time. And you could tick off any number of the same category. De Tocqueville is really writing journalism when he's writing about democracy in America. He came over here and he's a journalist, writing his impressions and so forth of this strange new country. Obviously, much journalism is ephemeral, but then so is much fiction in all its various forms.
Literature represents a certain set of characteristics. It seems to me that Vermont's characteristics are a little exclusive. I would want literature to be a broader term than he would define it as. He's asking that a work of literature have many of the aspects of a classic work of literature before he wants to assign that name to it. And I'd want to be a little more generous with the writers than that. But the question is a question of quality. Not a question of basic substance.
Many journalists have written both journalism and what passes for literature, or is called literature, an academe. I suppose Mark Twain comes immediately to mind. His Innocents Abroad, for example, is strictly journalism. It's just a travel book. But certainly it would be worthy of being taught in an English literature class. Certainly much of it can be read with as much pleasure and as much reward by people today as at the time he wrote it. He also, of course, wrote other things that maybe we wouldn't classify as journalism, Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, but they all sprang out of the same roots as Hugh was saying.
If we're going to try to make a distinction between journalism and literature, one that Ernest Hemingway tried to make once is really a pretty good one. Hemingway talked of journalism as what's happened in today's newspaper that has meaning and value for you only because it is happening to you in your world. And he wants to make literature, on the other hand, a form of writing which can communicate that immediacy and that sense of personal involvement that you get out of reading today's newspaper to people in other ages. Here again, the quality I think that we associate when we use the term journalism as generally a derogatory term in a context like this, the quality we're associating with journalism is really the quality of not merely being ephemeral as a form of writing, but of being, in a sense, elliptical in its dealing with causes, emotions, feelings, responses, and so on, depending upon the audience's emotional sets and prior knowledge for what's going on. You look at the front page of a newspaper, for example, and I suspect that if you could introduce an intelligent reader from the planet Mars and confront him with that front page, it would be a meaningless page. It does not supply him with the necessary background for understanding its relationship to him or any other human being. Literature tries, usually indirectly, to supply that other background. And in the common everyday acceptance of the distinction, I think that mm-hmm. probably is a part of it.
Well, a curious thing happened. Of course, I agree with Hugh that quality, whatever that is, that vague term, is really the separation. But a curious thing happens to journalism, the ephemeral part of journalism. For example, H.L. Mencken, writing about the Scopes trial, the so-called monkey trial, which was, what, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. He was writing for an immediate audience. It had an immediate appeal to people because they were interested in that issue of Darwinism versus fundamentalism in the Bible and so forth. And yet, you can sit down today and read Mencken's dispatches from the Scopes trial. They are very moving, they are fascinating, they are obviously extremely well done. They appeal to the modern reader in an entirely different way. There's a sort of a phase thing that goes on here that we are interested in a thing because of its immediacy. Then in the immediate period following, the immediacy thing goes out. Let enough time pass, and if the thing is done with quality to begin with, it can appeal to a different generation, a different time, for entirely different reasons and an entirely different way. I'll give you another example. During World War II, Robert Sherrod wrote a book on the Battle of Tarawa, which was, in a derogatory way, you might call it a potboiler, because it was done in tremendous haste after the battle. Factually, much of it is subject now to correction. And yet the book has been reprinted and reprinted till it's become a sort of classic. And yet it was written under haste, it was written under the pressure of time, deadline, and it is even inaccurate in places, because subsequent research has corrected some of the observations and things that he thought were factual. But for some mysterious reason, it has a quality in it that makes it appealing to an entirely different generation for entirely different reasons.
Could I make one other point that occurs to me about the relationship between literature and journalism? Norman Podhoretz has an interesting essay in one of his collections, and it has to do with the history of the novel. It may not be a history that would pass muster in an English department, but one of the things that he argues in this, and I think, in fact, wrongly, because I think he underestimates the survivability of the novel, but one point he makes, and I think it is his central point, is that in the old days, in the days of Dickens, Smollett, Sterne, all of the fathers of the English novel, as the very word suggests, it is related to the bringing of news about the world, nouvelle in French. It is the news, a novel in that sense. Defoe, I suppose, is the classic example of that. And those things like the one on the plague, and which have such an intense verisimilitude that you imagine it must be the work of a reporter, and yet it is in many ways an invented and imagined account.
Well, I think Defoe makes an interesting example.
Yeah.
This in the Robinson Crusoe, I would classify as certainly one of the earliest English novels, if not maybe the first. And it's very interesting that Defoe felt it a desirable, useful literary device to write it with as much verisimilitude and treat it as reportage of something that happened to a particular man, although in fact it is fiction.
Yes, literature opposing as journalism, whereas sometimes we have too much journalism posing as literature. Yeah.
But you know, the interesting thing about Defoe is that it was Defoe working as a journalist who produced Robinson Crusoe.
Oh, yes.
And who produced the Journal of the Plague Year and Moll Flanders and these other books. And what he was doing was creating, in all those cases, journalistic hoaxes. And presenting them to the public as though they were the literal truth, and thereby establishing credibility for them, both through the form in which he presented them as journalistic reporting, and through the way in which he piled up a body of detail so massive that it became finally convincing. The Journal of the Plague Year, for example, is an entirely fabricated piece of work, and yet it's one of the most convincing and harrowing pictures of a city under the siege of plague that exists anywhere in the world.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
The National Humanities Center recently convened a group of experts to investigate the relationships between journalism and literature. Participating in the discussion are Dr. Hugh Holman, a specialist in American writing at the University of North Carolina, Vermont Royster, former editor of the Wall Street Journal, and Edwin Yoder, the editorial page editor of the Washington Star. The discussion resumes with Edwin Yoder, followed in order by Hugh Holman and Vermont Royster.
Another point that occurs to me to add is really how many of the really important figures historically in literature, quote unquote, have cut their teeth in journalism. You mentioned Hemingway; he certainly is a classic example. Going back beyond that, think of Samuel Johnson, who before he undertook the dictionary and his great critical essays on Shakespeare and other forms, was I understand a very great parliamentary reporter, one of the first political reporters who actually and there again, if I remember correctly, a certain amount of invention was involved, because the way he reported the debates, they had a coherence and an eloquence which probably didn't exist on the floor of the House of Commons, and yet that is the appearance.
Of course, Dickens was a reporter, a remarkably fine reporter, perhaps at the time that he dropped working for newspapers and stuck to novel writing exclusively. He may have been the finest reporter in England at the time. A reporter in the sense of a working newsman reporter too. I mean, he was figuring out ways to beat the opposition to stories and setting up special series of fast horses to carry dispatches back to the newspaper and various things of this sort.
Well, I think one relatively modern example, of course, would be Walter Lippmann. Walter Lippmann was writing a three times a week column for the Herald Tribune and a syndicate, and writing about current events and current political happenings. The large body of what he wrote is vanished and wouldn't be worth reading. And yet, out of the enormous volumes of copy that he produced, there have been at least three books that I know of that have simply taken those Lippmann pieces and reprinted them, and yet so much of what he says, the generalized observations he makes, his philosophical observations, are pertinent today, even though he drew his conclusions and his thoughts from passing events. Furthermore, they are written with skill. It is simply good writing. I'm inclined to think, really, there are only two classes of written material, good writing and bad writing. And I think you find many examples of them in, quote, literature, end quote, and also in journalism. The thing that makes anything endure, whether it's literature or whether it's journalism, or for that matter, whether it's theater or movies, is this mysterious quality that I mentioned earlier, which gives it a quality which you as an individual reader can reread it or re-see it if it's a movie. And at the same time, it can appeal anew and afresh to a different generation.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. But I think that this business of style, whether journalism or literature, or whatever designation we give it, that is first the personality or sensibility of the writer and his use of the tools of his trade, his style. If that personality or sensibility is original enough, strong enough, emphatic enough, and interesting enough, it can survive very clumsy use of the tools of the trade, which is what happens in the case of Dreiser. I tell my students about Dreiser that he's a very consoling writer to read, because he proves that you don't have to be able to write well to be a great novelist. Now, on the other hand, the mere facility with the tools of the trade is almost worthless. Unless there is the sensibility, the personality, the statement that is being made, that can convert effective writing on the level of language into something of permanent value. We all know pieces of writing that we read in our youth and were delighted with, and we go back to and wonder how we could ever have been interested or fascinated by this kind of mindless approach to the world that it represents.
Well, I agree, certainly agree with you. In first place, I think for most creative people, whether they're writers, sculptors, painters, or what not, a knowledge of the tools of the craft and the ability to use the tool is very important. But I also agree with you that that is not the decisive factor. And I think this is also true in all forms of writing, whether we are talking about novels, short stories, plays, or what have you. It's a mysterious quality. But I insist that there's really no difference in this between what we call, quote, literature, end quote, and what we think of as, quote, journalism.
Vermont, not surprisingly, it seems to me, I think you've just defined journalism as simply professionalism.
No, to some extent, that is correct. That is an advantage, at least to me personally as a writer, in having a fixed space to write to, because it forces a compression on you. If writers such as Dickens and Thackeray had a weakness, is that there are great parts of them which you can just rapidly turn the pages, you can skim, because they were being paid by the word, they had so much to fill up for next week's issue. The one advantage of writing to space, it's kind of like in poetry writing a sonnet. I mean, the mere fact that you've got to do this in 14 lines is in itself a discipline. So there is some advantage, I agree with Hugh, that when space limitations disappear entirely, you can get things that are not as good as they could be simply because they're too long. I mentioned War and Peace. I would put that in that category, even though it is a great novel. But it would be helped, I think, by a little compression here and there.
Gentlemen, I wonder now if you'd turn your attention to the problems in journalism of accuracy and objectivity.
Well, one illustration of that I will call from the Washington Post. After the New Hampshire primary in 1976, the Washington Post lead story, the first paragraph, went something like this. What happened in New Hampshire yesterday doesn't mean very much, period, paragraph. And then the story went on for 21 inches. And inside, there was an equally long story by Dave Broder telling us all about what the meaningless New Hampshire primary meant. The Washington Post would have done better if they had just printed the lead paragraph of that story in 24 or 56 point type, put it in the middle of the front page, and thrown the rest of the copy away.
Well, I've said that one thing that's wrong with journalism is lacking in perspective of the kind that informs a genuine historical account of value. Another thing is there is so damn much pretentiousness in journalism. We really conduct, in a sense, a daily con game by pretending to know and to speak with authority on things which we, in fact, don't know very much about and can't speak with authority on.
Well, of course, one of the difficulties with journalism, particularly commentary, editorial writing, is that you feel compelled to say something in tomorrow's Greensboro Daily News about some subject, whether you have any ideas or not. When I was editor of the Wall Street Journal, I proposed once that we pick a day and we run the editorial column below the masthead completely blank, and that we put in the middle of it a little box which said, the editors could not today think of anything worth saying.
Now, I agree that a lot of editorial writing is, which I regard in that form as an outmoded form, has this pompous know-it-all, mm-hmm. tone, but I believe that that with the decline of the institutional importance of certain newspapers as institutions, if you believe it in the Sun and to see it in the Sun, yeah, it must be so, that kind of thing, no longer cuts much ice with most readers. What carries a comment is the merit and sense of the comment.
I'd like to make one point in defense of journalism, particularly, we'll say, editorial commentary. Mm-hmm. I had a letter not long ago from a reader who said, in effect, what gives you the right to sound off on everything that happens in Washington and in the world? You know, who the hell are you? Sort of a letter. And the only answer I have been able to think of that is that those of us in this peculiar craft are no smarter, no more intelligent, no more learned than the readers out there. We are paid a paltry sum, no doubt, but still we are paid, and our function is to do nothing but follow the news. We can, if we have enough gumption, we can read the entire State of the Union message. We can spend time poring over the government's budget or the state budget. We can take time out to go look up to read a bit about Afghanistan we didn't know before, the reader didn't know before either. And that is the only thing, I think, but I think it is something that gives us some credentials, in that we spend our time full time performing a function which the ordinary citizen, intelligent citizen, could do just as well as we do, except he doesn't have the time to do it.
I would say that I never am. I am not offended by what happens on the editorial page of the newspaper. I recognize there that a group of people are expressing their opinions. I value their opinions, I think, primarily for the same reason that you were describing. These are people whose job it is to keep up with these things, and they have opinions that probably are better informed than mine, which doesn't mean that I'm going to agree with them very often. It's in the news columns that in the news stories and in the feature stories and things of this sort, that it seems to me that journalism, if it misleads in this way, misleads most seriously and gives the most incomplete story.
Well, I'm sure in some reporting, among some reporters, there maybe is a conscious effort to point a story one way or another. But an awful lot of the problem with the news story, which Hugh is talking about, is it is often very difficult for the reporter to see more than a small part of the story.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, inviting you to listen this week for Soundings, the Center's radio program. Journalism and literature are the subjects this week on Soundings. Hugh Holman, professor at the University of North Carolina, Vermont Royster, the former editor of the Wall Street Journal, and Edwin Yoder, a Pulitzer Prize winner at the Washington Star, conduct a lively discussion of journalism, literature, and their connections. Join us this week for Soundings.